You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
What do a prospective groom and his buddies, a kind-hearted stripper, sexy Russian gangsters, an amorous orangutan, and Haitian refugees have in common? Well, usually not much, except when they all come together in the out-and-out, I don't know what word to use to describe this book. But
hilarious.
Hilarious book that is Pulitzer Prize winner Dave Barry's latest novel. It's called Insane City. It's published by Putnam, and it's Mr. Barry's 38th book, but his first solo adult novel in a decade. My.
That's a strange use of the word adult. But go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, you don't want kids reading this.
You've been No.
You've been writing books for young adults.
But not, this is not
with Ridley Pearson. This is all you, and this is not for young adults.
No.
But you have said that the really irritating thing about a novel is that you have to have a plot. So with that in mind, can you give us a brief synopsis of the plot of this book? Is that possible?
Well, you summed it up pretty well. There are a lot of strange characters in it, but basically it's a wedding that is supposed to take place in Miami, wedding between a kind of a slacker loser guy who tweets for a living and a very high-powered, very attractive, very rich woman who has planned the perfect, ultimate, beautiful, wonderful wedding. And they, unfortunately for them, decide to hold it in Miami. They're not from Miami. They're from Washington. They go down to Miami, where Miami kind of takes over the wedding, and everything that could possibly go wrong for them goes wrong.
Well, these are really a mismatched couple, aren't they? As you said, Seth Weinstein is Jewish. She's a high-powered D.C. lawyer, and her wealthy WASP parents strongly object to the marriage. Why are they getting married?
He's getting marrying her because she's hot, and she likes him, you know, and he can't believe his good fortune, Seth. He's a good-looking guy, but he hasn't accomplished anything. She views him as sort of a project, and Tina is a very can-do type A person, and she needs an accessory, a good-looking guy to be the father of her children as she pursues her amazing career,
and
she
figures, and accompany her to gala dinners.
Yeah, right. Exactly. He'll be on her arm. She'll be on his arm, and so in her mind, Seth is going to work out just fine. Her daddy will give him a job, and everything will be fine.
But was she likely to allow him to enter into the kinds of discussion she has with her friends about the Commerce Clause and things like that?
That bothers him greatly. At one scene, he ducks out to the bathroom at their beautiful restaurant where she and her Harvard Law graduate buddies are all talking about the Commerce Clause, and he has to go look that up on Wikipedia. And after reading it in the men's room stall, he still doesn't really understand what it is.
Well, to some degree, you get the feeling that she wants a husband she can feel superior to.
Exactly. She very much wants to be the one in control. And part of the plot of the book involves Seth ending up having to do something, having to make a decision, a moral decision, that she doesn't want him to make, and having to have the strength to do that.
Well, so you have this funny premise, and then you include, among all the wild escapades, a very serious subplot about Laurette, who is escaping from Haiti in a boat with her two children. And that is the thing that Seth has to deal with.
Yeah, that is the heart of the plot, and it's not funny at all.
I thought you meant it to be funny.
Well,
you
the
just
book is funny.
Weren't being as funny in that section.
Well, I guess if you see it as funny that the groom at this highfalutin wedding ends up housing three Haitians in his room, having them being cared for by a stripper that he did not hire, his groomsman hired for. And that is Seth's dilemma. What does he do? He ends up he rescues this woman and her two children from the Atlantic, right outside of the Ritz-Carlton on Key Biscayne. And then he becomes responsible for them. He doesn't want that responsibility. He's never been a guy to take responsibility or be cause-oriented. But there's a right and a wrong thing to do here. And Tina wants him to just get rid of them so she can have her perfect wedding. And that's Seth's dilemma.
And then you throw into the mix Trevor the orangutan and a python named Blossom.
Yeah, well, the python, we actually do have a great many pythons in Florida. In fact, right now, the state of Florida is sponsoring a hunt. We're inviting people from all over the nation. Come on down and shoot our pythons is pretty much the Florida motto, a moment for tourism.
Are pythons native to the—
No, they are not. These are Burmese pythons.
So they were brought in by—
Well, they're
pet lovers?
Exactly, and people who have probably tiny brains, not much bigger than the pythons, thought it would be a good idea to have these snakes that grow to be sometimes 15 feet long. And when that doesn't work out, they let them go.
They send them into the Everglades.
And exactly. Well, I think they find their own way to the Everglades. But it turns out to be Python heaven out there. There are literally, according to the estimates of the state, hundreds of thousands of pythons out there eating everything. So we now have people, amateurs, python hunters out there. But Trevor the orangutan was not meant to be a big-time character in this book. When I first wrote him in, there's a scene where Seth loses the wedding ring. But one of the many things that goes wrong for Seth is Trevor the orangutan gets hold of his wedding ring by a perfectly logical plot mechanism, I might say. It could happen to anybody.
Well, I've never had an orangutan.
Have you ever lost a wedding ring to an orangutan? No. See, but it's a common problem with a wedding. Make sure there's no orangutan around. Anyway, but Trevor... I was really just going to be a scene where he loses it to has to get it back from an orangutan. But I like Trevor so much that he becomes a main character in this book. And I hope becomes if there's a major motion picture, I hope Trevor's in it.
Now, this book has been compared with Bridezilla's because of the bride-to-be, Tina. The Hangover because of the antics of the so-called groom posse. You're often compared with that other funny Miami novelist, Carl Hiaasen. And they throw in every other humor writer. And you've even been described as a funnier Elmore Leonard. Do we hope to see it turn around someday where someone might say Mark Twain was an earlier Dave Barron?
Yeah, I'm waiting for that day. You could say that now, Leonard, if you want. I won't stop you.
But why do you think book reviewers are always comparing the writer at hand with someone else? Is this just an easy shorthand way of giving the reader a sense of the work that they're reviewing?
I guess so. It kind of bothers me. You know, I'll be honest. This is about a wedding, and it does involve a groom, but it really isn't. The plot has got nothing to do with The Hangover, which I thought was a very, very funny movie, and Bridesmaid. You know, in the sense that there's a bride and groom and all. But other than that, you know, it's about a wedding. But I don't know that I see that much similarity.
Well, cited P.G. Woodhouse as a major influence, and this is more Woodhousean, isn't it?
You
take a basic plot premise, and then you keep it throwing in these wild elements, and somehow it all works out at the end.
Yeah, when I wrote this book, when I write any book, the plotter I'm thinking of is P.G. Woodhouse. And not that I would compare myself ever to him. He was a master, but what I loved about his books was the way so many people were pursuing so many different concepts of reality, and yet they're all tangled up together in Blanding's Castle, or in this case, in Miami. I love that kind of book where there's just a lot of stuff going on and nobody's really aware of everything.
Now, you were a journalist for a long time. You started in a Westchester newspaper because you grew up in Westchester, and then you worked for the...
Westchester, Pennsylvania, we should stress. Westchester County, New York.
But then you went to Westchester. There are two separate words.
Yes.
And you worked for the AP. But how did you wind up in Florida?
The Miami Herald hired me, and through very poor planning on its part, the Miami Herald is located in Miami. Now, if they could move it, they probably would.
Well, today, considering what's going on in the newspaper business, it could be
anywhere,
it's closed down.
Exactly.
But you were happy to go to Florida?
Not at first. When they hired me, it was 1983, and they flew me down. This is the interview process. They flew me down. I get off the airport and rent a car, immediately get lost, and can't find anybody who can speak English, and which still is basically the case in Miami.
Parts of Miami.
There's a lot of parts of Miami where people just literally don't speak English. That is not the language people speak. And then, you know, I got lost. I saw cars with bullet holes in the sides. You know, there were riots going on. I thought, I cannot live here. I started going there after the Herald hired me. I worked from my house in Glen Mills, Pennsylvania. And I started going to Miami regularly to do stories, and I fell in love with the city. I began to see there was so much more to Miami than I had seen. I love it now. And I'm also married to a Cuban Jewish woman, so there's no way I could ever leave.
Well, was South Beach part of the mix in those days?
Because,
no. Because today when we think of Miami, at least New Yorkers think of Miami, unless they're Cubans, they think of South Beach.
Yeah. South Beach, when I first got there, the early 80s, was – these decrepit old, they're beautiful, the Art Deco hotels, but they were run down. The people living in them were either marialitos or really, really just senior citizens who were down and out. And you'd see people sitting on their aluminum chairs in front of the hotels all day, and that was it. Then in the late 80s, early 90s, it started to turn around. They renovated all those hotels. Now at South Beach is this hot, fabulous night spot. full of people with tiny clothes. Well, the women have
very little clothing. Yeah. Tom Wolfe's Back to Blood was published recently. It's also a comic novel set in Florida. I don't know if you knew.
He got that idea from me, I think.
But is this just because South Florida is a totally crazy place?
Yeah, I mean,
could you write these books set anywhere else in America?
Oh, here I am sitting in New York City, and it'd be the last person to say New York doesn't have lots of crazy things going on. But Miami, which has been my home now for going on 26, 27 years, is a very unusual city. And things that happen there, it's hard to imagine them happening anywhere else.
Well, didn't you once write a story criticizing New York City after the New York Times published a negative article about South Florida? Is that the pot calling the kettle black?
Well, what happened was the New York Times, I believe 1987 magazine, ran a cover story, Can Miami Save Itself? Now, this is like 1987. We had been through, you know, years and years of riots and drug. It's not like the New York Times was committing groundbreaking journalism. And so we had the idea at Tropic Magazine where we're like, okay, so they've discovered that Miami has a crime and drug problem after these. Let's go up to New York City. Now, bear in mind, this is 1987. And see if there's any problems there. You know, we come in, of course, 87 is not the city that it was. It is now.
We
found that there were problems here.
We've kind of turned things around, or at least we hope that we
have. Yeah, no, it's a lot.
Well, you've also said that everything that you write about, you can find some inspiration for in the newspaper, reading the Miami Herald. Did any of the things in this book actually occur?
Yeah. The groom's party immediately upon arrival in Miami gets in a taxi that is unable to find Key Biscayne. This personally has happened to me. Miami's the only place I've ever lived in my life where the taxi drivers apparently are unfamiliar with the city where they're driving. They're much more familiar with, I don't know, Jamaica. They don't know Miami.
Do people ride a lot of cabs in Miami?
It's kind of hard to get them. Yeah. And if you do,
it's like getting a cab in L.A.
It's also like roulette. You don't really know where you're going to let. They're going to let you off. Then they end up on South Beach where they are befriended by some very attractive women with accents who want them to come to a private party, which turns out to be they're working for Russian mobsters. And this also happens regularly in South Beach. There's a character who walks around with a gigantic stake around his shoulders at all times. These guys exist in Miami. There are people like that.
Well, you began writing humorous pieces as a columnist. Those are short pieces. They were comments on what was going on in the world. You won a Pulitzer Prize. I don't know, after you won that in 1998, did you check to see if any other humorists had won a Pulitzer?
Well, I was 88,
88, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Art Buchwald won a Pulitzer Prize. I believe Russell Baker won a Pulitzer Prize. I don't know that Russell's stuff was all humor, but most people would consider him a humorist. Yeah.
So was that what you thought you were going to be doing the rest of your life? When did you start thinking about writing novels and having to come up with plots, even though you steal the plots from the newspapers?
A guy at Putnam's who's still my editor, Neil Nyron, we had done a thing with Elmore Leonard and Carl Hyacin and some other South Florida authors at the Miami Herald Sunday Magazine Tropic. We wrote a novel called Naked Came the Manatee, an homage to Naked Came the Stranger from the writers at Newsday. And everybody wrote a chapter. I wrote the first chapter, and Carl Hyacin wrote the last chapter, and Elmore Leonard, I think, wrote the second to the last chapter. And we had a lot of fun and actually got made into a book. And the guy who edited the book was Neil Nyron, who still works for Putnam. And he liked my chapter and said, would you be interested in trying a novel? And that I did, and that became Big Trouble, which was the first novel I wrote.
Is this a good time in American history to be a humorist? You in 2010, you wrote a history of the millennium so far, which covered a decade, the Bush years until the Bush years. Which has been funnier, the Bush administration or the Obama administration?
Well, it's kind of hard. That's a hard question. I mean, the humor, it's always there. There's always funny stuff going on. The government is consistently hilarious. It's the main thing it does well. I kind of feel that you're not allowed to make jokes about the Obama administration the way you were allowed to make jokes of the Bush administration. I think this, for the most part, most of the entertainment industry is liberal. They're more reluctant to make fun of.
But you're a libertarian.
I'm a libertarian. I can do whatever I want. But I just feel that there's this general cultural reluctance. I mean, we can make fun of stuff around the Obama administration, but not the president himself, the way generally I think they felt more comfortable in the past.
Because he's African-American?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Don't you? I mean, you don't sense any reluctance at all?
I make bitter jokes about everybody in power.
But I don't think that it's any, you know, that the political system in this country is any less funny than it used to be. I do think people are more likely now to make fun in the form of tweets, and then they sitting down and writing columns is kind of getting past that.
Do you tweet?
I do tweet.
And you have a character here, of course, who makes a living as a tweeter.
My guy, Seth is his job, the loser that he is, the only job he could get was tweeting about products ranging from forklifts to douche.
Well, yeah, in fact, she is very contemptuous of his douche tweets.
No, he kind of wins her over when she starts reading his douche tweets at a scene at the restaurant and decides they're pretty funny, actually. And Seth he's afraid he's going to lose her right then and there, but she's intrigued.
Wasn't your father a Presbyterian minister?
He was.
Was your home a barrel of laughs when you were growing up?
Well, yeah, my dad was a minister and his dad was a minister. But he worked in New York City here and for the New York City Mission Society. So he was really more of a social worker, although he did, you know, occasionally preach at churches. But he was a very funny guy. He smoked and drank. He liked humor. It wasn't like I was the parson's kid and, you know, couldn't do anything.
Are you being made rich by the success of Peter and the Starcatchers?
The play?
Yeah.
No, I am not being made rich by
that.
But
you wrote the book. and you know, I've always wondered about that connection, the Barry connection.
J.M. Barry, but he spelled his name wrong. But I don't know if you've seen it, but it's an amazing play. Ridley Pearson and I wrote the book, Peter and the Starcatchers, plural. And
that's why I brought it up.
Rick Ellis, thank you. Rick Ellis, who wrote Jersey Boys, adapted it for the stage, and he changed so much around in such a wonderful way. I cannot claim any credit for this wonderful play, but I'm astonished by how good it is.
This is your first adult novel in 10 years. Are you going to write another one soon, or are you back to the kids?
No, I think I'm going to write a book of essays, and then I'll write another novel. But I'll never stop writing. I want to write more books for kids because kids are great, great readers.
If you need new material, you can also move to Las Vegas for a while. Don't you think?
I guess Las Vegas, but you have to live there, right? You can't just visit it.
Uh-huh. And could you have written about Miami the way you do if you didn't live
no,
there?
No. I would, and I am contemptuous of people. Like Tom Wolfe, to his credit, spent many, 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 many months down there before he started writing about it. But there are people who just like, when they write about it, you can tell they've never actually lived there.
Barry Lopez, who's a wonderful writer on a nonfiction writer, told me once that when he went to an Inuit village, the villager said about a journalist, one day, newspaper article, 2 days, magazine article, 5 days, book.
Tragically, they're right. The Inuits have got that figured out.
Insane City is Dave Barry's latest book. It is an adult novel. It's published by Putnam. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.